Chapter 74. More old soldiers than one, Mr. George has not far to ride with folded arms upon the box, for their destination is Lincoln's Inn Fields. When the driver stops his horses, Mr. George alights, and looking in at the window, says, "What, Mr. Tulkinghorn's your man, is he?" "Yes, my dear friend." "Do you know him, Mr. George?" "Why, I have heard of him, seen him too, I think. But I don't know him, and he don't know me." There ensues the carrying of Mr. Smallweed upstairs, which is done to perfection with the trooper's help. He is borne into Mr. Tulkinghorn's great room, and deposited on the turkey rug before the fire. Mr. Tulkinghorn is not within at the present moment, but will be back directly. The occupant of the pew in the hall, having said thus much, stirs the fire and leaves the triumvirate to warm themselves. Mr. George is mightily curious in respect of the room. He looks up at the painted ceiling, looks round at the old law books, contemplates the portraits of the great clients, reads aloud the names on the boxes. "Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet," Mr. George reads thoughtfully. "Ha! Manor of Chesney Wold. Apostrophe humph." Mr. George stands looking at these boxes a long while as if they were pictures, and comes back to the fire repeating, "Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet, and Manor of Chesney Wold, hey? Worth a mint of money, Mr. George," whispers Grandfather Smallweed, rubbing his legs. "Powerfully rich. Who do you mean? This old gentleman, or the Baronet?" "This gentleman, this gentleman." "So I have heard, and knows a thing or two, I'll hold a wager." "Not bad quarters either," says Mr. George, looking round again. "See the strong box yonder." This reply is cut short by Mr. Tulkinghorn's arrival. There is no change in him, of course. Rustily dressed, with his spectacles in his hand, and their very case worn threadbare. In manner, close and dry. In voice, husky and low. In face, watchful behind a blind, habitually not uncensorious and contemptuous perhaps. The peerage may have warmer worshippers, and faithfuller believers than Mr. Tulkinghorn, after all, if everything were known. "Good morning, Mr. Smallweed. Good morning," he says as he comes inches. "You have brought the sergeant, I see. Sit down, sergeant." As Mr. Tulkinghorn takes off his gloves, and puts them in his hat, he looks with half-closed eyes across the room to where the trooper stands, and says within himself, "Perchance, you'll do, my friend." "Sit down, sergeant," he repeats as he comes to his table, which is set on one side of the fire, and takes his easy chair. "Cold and raw this morning, cold and raw." Mr. Tulkinghorn warms before the bars, alternately, the palms and knuckles of his hands and looks from behind that blind which is always down, at the trio sitting in a little semicircle before him. "Now, I can feel what I am about as perhaps he can in two senses, Mr. Smallweed. The old gentleman is newly shaken up by duty, to bear his part in the conversation. You have brought our good friend the sergeant, I see." "Yes, sir," returns Mr. Smallweed, very servile to the lawyer's wealth and influence. "And what does the sergeant say about this business?" "Mr. George," says Grandfather Smallweed with a tremulous wave of his shriveled hand, "this is the gentleman, sir." Mr. George salutes the gentleman, but otherwise sits bolt upright and profoundly silent, very forward in his chair, as if the full complement of regulation appendages for a field day hung about him. Mr. Tulkinghorn proceeds, "Well, George, I believe your name is George?"
"It is so, sir."
"What do you say, George?" "I ask your pardon, sir," returns the trooper, "but I should wish to know what you say. Do you mean in point of reward?"
"I mean in point of everything, sir."
This is so very trying to Mr. Smallweed's temper, that he suddenly breaks out with, "You're a brimstone beast," and as suddenly asks pardon of Mr. Tulkinghorn, excusing himself for this slip of the tongue by saying to Judy, "I was thinking of your grandmother, my dear."
I supposed, Sergeant, Mr. Tulkinghorn resumes as he leans on one side of his chair and crosses his legs, that Mr. Smallweed might have sufficiently explained the matter. It lies in the smallest compass, however. You served under Captain Auden at one time, and were his attendant in illness, and rendered him many little services, and were rather in his confidence, I am told. That is so, is it not?
Yes, sir, that is so, says Mr. George with military brevity. Therefore you may happen to have in your possession something, anything, no matter what, accounts, instructions, orders, a letter, anything in Captain Auden's writing. I wish to compare his writing with some that I have. If you can give me the opportunity, you shall be rewarded for your trouble. 3, 4, 5 guineas, you would consider handsome, I dare say. Noble, my dear friend, cries Grandfather Smallweed, screwing up his eyes. If not, say how much more, in your conscience as a soldier, you can demand. There is no need for you to part with the writing, against your inclination, though I should prefer to have it. Mr. George sits squared in exactly the same attitude, looks at the painted ceiling, and says never a word. The irascible Mr. Smallweed scratches the air. The question is, says Mr. Tulkinghorn in his methodical, subdued, uninterested way, first, whether you have any of Captain Auden's writing? First, whether I have any of Captain Auden's writing, sir, repeats Mr. George. Secondly, what will satisfy you for the trouble of producing it? Secondly, what will satisfy me for the trouble of producing it, sir, repeats Mr. George. Thirdly, you can judge for yourself, whether it is at all like that, says Mr. Tulkinghorn, suddenly handing him some sheets of written paper tied together. Whether it is at all like that, sir? Just so, repeats Mr. George. All three repetitions Mr. George pronounces in a mechanical manner, looking straight at Mr. Tulkinghorn. Nor does he, so much as glance at the affidavit in Jarndyce and Jarndyce, that has been given to him for his inspection, though he still holds it in his hand, but continues to look at the lawyer with an air of troubled meditation. Well? Says Mr. Tulkinghorn. What do you say?
Well, sir, replies Mr. George, rising erect and looking immense, I would rather, if you'll excuse me, have nothing to do with this.
Mr. Tulkinghorn, outwardly quite undisturbed, demands, why not?
Why, sir, returns the trooper. Except on military compulsion, I am not a man of business. Among civilians I am what they call in Scotland a ne'er-do-weel. I have no head for papers, sir. I can stand any fire better than a fire of cross questions. I mentioned to Mr. Smallweed, only an hour or so ago, that when I come into things of this kind I feel as if I was being smothered. And that is my sensation, says Mr. George, looking round upon the company, at the present moment. With that, he takes three strides forward, to replace the papers on the lawyer's table, and three strides backward, to resume his former station, where he stands perfectly upright, now looking at the ground and now at the painted sailg, with his hands behind him, as if to prevent himself from accepting any other document whatever. Under this provocation, Mr. Smallweed's favorite adjective of disparagement is so close to his tongue, that he begins the words my dear friend with a monosyllable brim, thus converting the possessive pronoun into brimmy and appearing to have an impediment in his speech. Once past this difficulty, however, he exhorts his dear friend in the tenderest manner not to be rash, but to do what so eminent a gentleman requires, and to do it with a good grace, confident that it must be unobjectionable as well as profitable. Mr. Tulkinghorn merely utters an occasional sentence, as, you are the best judge of your own interest, Sergeant. Take care you do no harm by this. Please yourself. Please yourself. If you know what you mean, that's quite enough. These he utters with an appearance of perfect indifference as he looks over the papers on his table, and prepares to write a letter. Mr. George looks distrustfully from the painted ceiling to the ground, From the ground to Mr. Smallweed, from Mr. Smallweed to Mr. Tulkinghorn, and from Mr. Tulkinghorn to the painted ceiling again, often in his perplexity changing the leg on which he rests. I do assure you, sir, says Mr. George, not to say it offensively, that between you and Mr. Smallweed here, I really am being smothered 50 times over. I really am, sir. I am not a match for you gentlemen. Will you allow me to ask why you want to see the captain's hand, in the case that I could find any specimen of it? Mr. Tulkinghorn quietly shakes his head. No. If you were a man of business, Sergeant, you would not need to be informed that there are confidential reasons, very harmless in themselves, for many such wants in the profession to which I belong. But if you are afraid of doing any injury to Captain Auden, you may set your mind at rest about that. He is dead, sir. Is he? Mr. Tulkinghorn quietly sits down to write. Well, sir, says the trooper, looking into his hat after another disconcerted pause, I am sorry not to have given you more satisfaction. If it would be any satisfaction to anyone, that I should be confirmed in my judgment, that I would rather have nothing to do with this by a friend of mine who has a better head for business than I have, and who is an old soldier, I am willing to consult with him. I really am so completely smothered myself at present, says Mr. George, passing his hand hopelessly across his brow, that I don't know but what it might be a satisfaction to me. Mr. Smallweed, hearing that this authority is an old soldier, so strongly inculcates the expediency of the troopers taking counsel with him, and particularly informing him of its being a question of 5 guineas or more, that Mr. George engages to go and see him. Mr. Tulkinghorn says nothing either way. I'll consult my friend, then, by your leave, sir, says the trooper, and I'll take the liberty of looking in again with the final answer in the course of the day. Mr. Smallweed, if you wish to be carried downstairs, in a moment, my dear friend, in a moment, will you first let me speak half a word with this gentleman in private? Certainly, sir. Don't hurry yourself on my account. The trooper retires to a distant part of the room, and resumes his curious inspection of the boxes, strong and otherwise. If I wasn't as weak as a brimstone baby, sir, whispers Grandfather Smallweed, drawing the lawyer down to his level by the lapel of his coat, and flashing some half-quenched green fire out of his angry eyes, I'd tear the writing away from him. He's got it buttoned in his breast. I saw him put it there. Judy saw him put it there. Speak up, you crabbed image for the sign of a walking stick shop, and say you saw him put it there. This vehement conjuration the old gentleman accompanies with such a thrust at his granddaughter, that it is too much for his strength, and he slips away out of his chair, drawing Mr. Tulkinghorn with him, until he is arrested by Judy, and well shaken. Violence will not do for me, my friend, Mr. Tulkinghorn then remarks coolly. No, I know, sir. But it's chafing and galling, it's worse than your smattering, chattering magpie of a grandmother, to the imperturbable Judy, who only looks at the fire, to know he has got what's wanted, and won't give it up. He, not to give it up. He, a vagabond. But never mind, sir, never mind. At the most, he has only his own way for a little while. I have him periodically in a vice. I'll twist him, sir. I'll screw him, sir. If he won't do it with a good grace, I'll make him do it with a bad one, sir. Now, my dear Mr. George, says Grandfather Smallweed, winking at the lawyer hideously as he releases him, I am ready for your kind assistance, my excellent friend. Mr. Tulkinghorn, with some shadowy sign of amusement manifesting itself through his self-possession, stands on the hearthrug with his back to the fire, watching the disappearance of Mr. Smallweed, and acknowledging the trooper's parting salute with one slight nod. It is more difficult to get rid of the old gentleman, Mr. George finds, than to bear a hand in carrying him downstairs, for when he is replaced in his conveyance, He is so loquacious on the subject of the guineas, and retains such an affectionate hold of his button, having, in truth, a secret longing to rip his coat open, and rob him that some degree of force is necessary on the trooper's part to effect a separation. It is accomplished at last, and he proceeds alone in quest of his adviser. By the cloisterly temple, and by Whitefriars Stair, not without a glance at Hanging Sword Alley, which would seem to be something in his way, and by Blackfriars Bridge, and Blackfriars Road, Mr. George sedately marches to a street of little shops lying somewhere in that ganglion of roads from Kent and Surrey, and of streets from the bridges of London, centering in the far-famed Elephant, who has lost his castle formed of 1,004-horse coaches to a stronger iron monster than he, ready to chop him into mincemeat any day he dares. To one of the little shops in this street, which is a musician's shop, having a few fiddles in the window, and some pans, pipes, and a tambourine, and a triangle, and certain elongated scraps of music, Mr. George directs his massive tread. And halting at a few paces from it, as he sees a soldierly-looking woman, with Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.